This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Okay, rubbing hands together. Welcome back to the second part of the Financial Sense News Hour. Jim Poplava and John Loeffler here with you. This is the part of the show we call the Big Picture, in which, since we are all awash in data points, we attempt to put some perspective behind what's happening. The first perspective that we have to do here, Jim, is a number of our listeners suggested through emails that we need to stop taking our vacation time in August, which we've been doing traditionally every single year at the end of August, because something actually happens. As a matter of fact, when we travel in August, I take my broadcast kit with me so I can be ready to do a radio show here from anywhere, because something might happen. And quite often on vacation, it has done that. This time we had hurricanes Harvey and Irma. Actually, it's the worst hurricane season since 2005. It's been a very calm series of hurricane seasons over the last few years, as a matter of fact. There is geopolitical turbulence going on out there because North Korea detonated a hydrogen bomb. We have two more hurricanes on the way, and Mexico is struggling to deal with an 8.1 earthquake that happened overnight going into Friday morning, which has affected the states of Oaxaca and Chiapas. Worst of all, fortunately, although it was an 8.1, it was offshore, but still there was a death toll. Many buildings collapsed and other related issues to earthquakes. All of this, by the way, points you to what we have said here on the program about the concept of emergency preparedness, something we should all do as a part of lifetime planning. But let's get back to finances. As we mentioned in the first part of the show, Jim, we seem to be entering a seasonal time of the year, autumn, in the Northern Hemisphere, which could bring about, well, actually, it could bring about the perfect financial storm as we see the confluence of all these issues.
Well, you take a look at the perfect financial storm as we saw both in 2000 and once again in 2007. It certainly is a possibility, John. We have weather-related issues, and of course, we're doing this show on Friday. We have no idea what Irma's devastation is going to be like once it hits landfall Friday night in Florida. But behind Irma are two more hurricanes, one projected to hit the Gulf area and another one the East Coast. So you don't know how bad. I mean, literally, the U.S. could be buffeted by a series of weather-related storms, and we've seen how it wreaked havoc in Houston, especially there with all those refineries and the impact on gasoline. Of course, we have geopolitical, and basically in North Korea, they just seem to be putting aside any kind of possible actions taken by the U.S. or anybody else. Not only are they firing missiles, they fired, 2 weeks ago, they fired missiles over Japan, and then over Labor Day weekend, they detonated a hydrogen bomb. So you have geopolitical, and of course, you also have political issues in Washington, because they wanted an $8 billion relief bill that they wanted to get to Houston, and then they wanted to tie that to a debt ceiling debate. And you know what happens in Washington, John, anytime you try to attach something that is really necessary to a bigger issue, it never gets done. And so the president cut a deal. Republicans are ticked off. Democrats are happy. So you have all kinds of political machinations going on in Washington. And you do have the potential for a perfect financial storm.
So I guess the summary of what we're talking about here, and we began the conversation in the first hour of the show, is given these possibilities that we've discussed, people need to take this storm a little more seriously. We have a confluence of things coming together which could create some issues. Anything that might ameliorate that would negate the confluence?
I mean, if there's anything that would lessen the impact, is right now the best thing going is the economy. And one of the things you have heard myself and us mention here on the program in the Big Picture over the last couple of years, when the economy is doing well, the markets are better able to absorb shocks when the economy is growing. And right now, that acts as a shock absorber and better able to absorb any kind of shocks, whether it's weather-related, as we've seen with Harvey and now Irma, or any other kind of geopolitical events. And so that, John, I would say right off the bat, the best thing going right now is we still have strong economic growth. The second quarter GDP numbers were revised up to 3%. The unemployment rate is low. So right now, if there's anything bad happening, at least the economy is still growing. The problems you get to is when the economy is in a recession, you no longer have a shock absorber to handle any kind of disruptive events, whether they're geopolitical, financial, of any kind, like bankruptcies, as we saw in 2007, or political infighting, as we're seeing in Washington now.
Okay, well, obviously, what are you and your crew there then watching closely that you see as being potential problem areas?
Well, I mean, you know, the Fed is still talking about raising interest rates, although recently you've had several Fed governors come out and say, hey, you know, maybe we need to slow it down. We're not getting the inflation numbers. But, you know, the Fed is still talking about shrinking its balance sheet. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out of this September meeting that's coming up here shortly, especially with the weather-related events, which are literally wreaking havoc in the Southwest and, of course, the Eastern Seaboard, because the time we're doing this show, we really don't know the full impact of Irma on Florida and on the East Coast. The other thing we have is the ECB is talking about ending its taper, and the Bank of Canada just raised interest rates this week. So as long as central banks are talking about it and still continue to do it, we're always at risk. So these are the things I think you have to watch. And we're also seeing some elevated spreads between the corporate bond market and sovereigns. It's nothing that's really elevated at this point, but it is something we're keeping close eyes on.
Well, I know some of the worries that we've talked about here at length are, I mean, this is the second longest bull market in stock market history. And as you pointed out, Jim, stock valuations are elevated. We're seeing political turmoil globally. Now, how that impacts things depends on what's developing, but you can't always predict that ahead of time. We've got a lot of political issues going here in the United States with the Congress, and we don't need to go into all of that right now, but obviously there is stuff going on. Maybe it's not enough to derail a stock market, which so far has been able to take things in stride. But, you know, as you say, behind every bear market is a recession. Behind every recession is a rate raising cycle. And voila, here we are. We're in a rate raising cycle.
Right now, we have two conditions that are present for a sharp sell-off. And I think if we get anything, it's more of a sharp sell-off than it is a bear market. Stock valuations are the highest that we've seen since the dot-com bust. And you just don't see severe corrections in the market or a bear market without a recession, nor do you see severe corrections when stock markets are undervalued as they were in 2009 and 2010. The other thing is you have going is the Fed is trying to normalize interest rates. They have given no indication yet, other than maybe a few governors recently have said, maybe we need to take our foot off the brakes just a little bit. But we've seen stock markets correct in this bull market. If everybody can think back in 2011, it really looked like we were heading into a bear market and recession because we had a 20% correction. 2013 was another year of turbulence with the tapering, and 2016, let's not forget, we began 2016. First 6 weeks of the year, the stock market was down every single week, which was one reason why the Fed held off till the end of the year to raising rates. But the real key here is recession. When the market's correct, you can handle a correction. But if the correction occurs in the midst of a recession, then folks, look out below, because that's when you really get these big drop-offs that we've seen. You know, the drop of 58% in the S&P between 2007 and 2009, and likewise a similar drop between 2000 and 2002. Now, that's one reason why the markets are watching the Fed rate hikes, and also tax cuts coming out of Washington, because everybody knows this is what we're 8 years, 9 years into this business cycle. The Fed is raising interest rates. Well, what's going to offset that? And that's why they're looking at tax cuts. And John, if we get a miracle of tax cuts, I think it's going to be much to do about nothing, because it'll be so scaled back that it really won't have much of an impact. I mean, we would be lucky. There does seem to be some agreement, or more agreement, between both parties to cut corporate taxes rather than there is to cut individual taxes. So those are, I guess, some of the things that are offsetting some of the worries about overvaluation and also the Fed raising rates. And we'll get to assessment here just shortly when we talk about the possibility of the Fed raising interest rates in December, which was widely anticipated after their last round of rate hikes.
So why is it, Jim, that the market then is looking for some form of stimulus, because the economy is doing okay? I mean, it is growing. It's not a barn burner, but it is positive growth.
John, there's growing signs that the consumer is stretched. The savings rate has dipped, so consumers have been falling more and more on their savings to continue spending. And you've heard that debt levels don't look as bad. Well, debt levels have continued to grow since the Great Recession. The only difference is the value of homes have gone up in value. The stock market has gone up threefold. So the debt doesn't look as bad. And that's because asset values, the Fed was very successful inflating asset values. There's also signs recently that the housing market is starting to show signs of cooling. And we had an economic report, which we're paying a lot more attention to. The Philly Fed coincident indicator has tumbled to 36 in July from 68 in May. And the Philly Fed usually is a sort of an advanced indicator of things to come. So if next month the Philly Fed indicator continues to drop, that is telling us down the road that we could, by the time we get to Q4 or Q1 of next year, this economy could be close to stall speed. And if we don't have a tax cut to revive it, then we could be heading for trouble. And especially if the Fed continues to be aggressive, either in reducing its balance sheet or raising interest rates, then you could have what we call the perfect storm.
I would think, though, you know, as we go forward here, however, some of these weather-related events have to take some kind of a toll. I mean, first of all, let's go to Texas after Hurricane Harvey. It disrupted gas production in a lot of the refineries there because they're located there along the Gulf Coast. Then there's reconstruction money that has to go into rebuilding a lot of these areas. All of this affects somehow investment. So at some point or another, I would think it takes a toll.
Well, it does, and you're seeing it already reflected in unemployment claims, which rise, obviously, if you can't get to work or your business is shut down or you can't even drive to work, as many of these people, you know, that's going to affect economic activity. So the economic numbers that you're going to see in the month of September, October, and probably even November, depends on how late this hurricane season lasts. Remember, even though Irma is hitting Florida, there's two more hurricanes that are heading in the same direction that are building up, and it'll be interesting to see how strong they get, because Irma was a Cat 5 when it hit the Caribbean. And John, it's been years since we've seen a Cat 5 storm, and Cat 5s or even Cat 4s can wreak a lot of damage, as we saw happen in the Houston and Texas area. So a lot of these economic numbers, you're going to have to watch very closely. I would look at more of what's going to happen in the broader part of the economy. And that's one reason we watch the Philly Fed Index, to watch the economies of the 50 states. Because if you're seeing maybe economic weakness in Texas or Florida or any of those areas that were damaged by weather, then you can put that aside. What I'm going to be looking at, and what we're watching at our firm, we're watching the other states in the country and seeing how well they're doing economically. But there are some signs right now that credit spreads are starting to widen, which is something that we're watching. Now, it's not quite elevated yet that you could say that you would say there's trouble there. Nonetheless, credit spreads have widened by over a half a percentage. The other thing that we're watching, which is something that, you know, John Kosar and I talked about in hour one, the 10-year yield is also falling. But here, once again, this could be distorted, and it could be distorted by the spreads between what you can earn on a treasury note or a treasury bill here in the U.S. and what you can earn in Europe. So a lot of that European money has been coming into the U.S. because our bond yields are higher. The other thing that it could be as well, you know, everybody knows that this time of the year, the markets tend to be more volatile. So you always see a little bit of a rotation. And we saw that with inflows going into some of the ETFs and mutual funds. So this could be part of the safety trade. However, we start breaking 2%, or as John talked about, 1.95, that could be indicative of something is out there on the horizon on the economic front that we are heading towards more elevated economic risk. So here's the difficulty you're going to have as an investor. A lot of these economic numbers, you can paint them in any which way you currently feel. Like if you're leaning bearish, then any economic number you see coming out after these hurricanes that shows weakness, you can make a bearish case. On the other hand, if you're bullish, you might want to ignore them. So we really don't have any clear, any of these numbers that we're going to see in the next couple months are going to be distorted, and they're going to have to be put into perspective.
Now, given the conversation we've had about diversifying more into bonds rather than 100% being invested in stocks, you've been saying that last couple of months, as a matter of fact, what are you actually doing for your clients?
A couple things. Number one, if there's real serious trouble coming to the economy or the financial markets, the bond market will sniff it out first. And it's one reason we aren't fully invested. I mean, we do own bonds, and the stocks that we own are more on the defensive side. And our bond position is 20 to 40% right now. And even those things that we own, like healthcare, we own some utilities, and we tend to be have a stronger component overseas where the stock markets are less vulnerable to what you're seeing going on in the United States. In fact, the international markets have been outperforming the U.S. markets throughout this year. So, John, we are at this stage of the market cycle with the stock market elevations being where they are, with the Fed raising rates. We've got central banks tightening. The Bank of Canada just raised interest rates again. We've got geopolitical risk in Asia with North Korea. Washington is totally dysfunctional. I just think you have to be crazy to be fully invested in market index funds or not have some form of insurance, as John and I talked about in hour one. Imagine if you live in Florida or in Texas and you have no flood insurance. Folks, you know, I don't care what kind of investor you are or how smart you think you are, you might want to have some insurance.
Well, we know that recessions have not gone away. Things are going to go in cycles and they'll return again. And with that, of course, we have bear markets. They come about with recessions. When this storm does come, what category are we talking about? Is it going to be another category 5, or are we talking about something a lot milder?
Actually, a 20.
And that's why I'm moving to Thailand.
I think the next downturn is not going to be just a regular bear market. And the reason I say that is the market functions much different today than it was 10 years ago with the emergence of ETFs and index funds. And let me tell you why. There's $2.4 trillion that are sitting in equity ETFs. And why that's important. Let's say I'm a money manager and I'm managing individual stocks. I need to raise money because I see risk in the markets. Maybe the economy's slowing down. I can look at my portfolio and I can cherry pick and say, all right, let's take some profits out of this stock, get rid of this stock, or maybe, you know, this one isn't doing well and it could be subject to weakness in the economy. So let's say that. So you can be more selective in what you're doing. Unfortunately, the vast majority of investment advisors and individual investors all own the same ETFs. They all own these passive index funds. So when investors get out, when everyone bails out, everyone is selling and will be dumping the same stocks at the same time, which will exert enormous downward pressure on the stock prices. In other words, if you own an S&P ETF or index fund or a NASDAQ fund or a Dow, diamonds, whatever it is you own, when you get out of those, let's say that I am the purveyor of an index fund, and we manage, $1 trillion, like several of these companies do, whether it's Fidelity or Vanguard. Actually, it's trillions of dollars. And all of a sudden, the accounting department notifies the manager, hey, we just got $200 million worth of liquidations come in over the weekend or during the day. What that means is the manager is going to have to sell equal weights of all 500 of those stocks. He's not going to ask and say, well, gosh, this stock is undervalued. I don't want to sell that. If you're in a NASDAQ fund and 11% of the index is made up of Amazon, well, guess what? 11% of your portfolio is going to get liquidated, and it's going to be Amazon. The other thing, too, is the investment markets have grown extremely more complex today, with trading really dominated by the machines and algorithms as they battle for shares of stock. So the financial system is very vulnerable to what we've seen occur several times, these flash crashes and panics that become self-defeating. Because what happens when you see, let's say, the Dow go down 500 points in a single day, or the Dow goes down 1,000 points in a single week? Well, what's going to happen? People are going to panic. They're all going to rush to the exit gates at the same time. You're an index fund. You're liquidating index funds. As the index fund has to liquidate those stocks, what does that do? It puts more downward pressure on the market. And all of a sudden, you get this snowball effect, and it starts to become an avalanche. So that is why it's important, and why so many people, as I talked about in the market wrap, are becoming disenchanted with Washington. Because if you don't get tax cuts done by the end of the year to offset what the Fed has done in rate hikes, not to mention the fact we're getting into an aging business cycle, debt has built up in the corporate sector, debt has built up in the individual sector, and debt is built up in the government sector. So you've got a Fed raising interest rates, government debt costs are increasing, corporate debt costs are increasing, and at the same time, consumer debt costs are increasing. So right now, corporations and individuals are maxed out on credit. So the economy is going to need some form of stimulus to sustain it. And right now, so far, the Fed has not relented on rate hikes or shrinking its balance sheet. And we're going to get our first clue here coming up in the next week or two with the Fed meeting this month in terms of what does the Fed say? Do they back off maybe on terms of shrinking their balance sheet? Or is it hell's bells, full steam ahead? We still see another rate hike coming. We're still going to shrink our balance sheet. That would not be good news for the markets, because it's basically saying the Fed is ignoring all the warnings all around it. So that's why, John, this is a very precarious situation.
You know, one of the sort of oddities out there is that the futures market seems to be getting their projections more correct more often than the Federal Reserve. And as I recall, futures was projecting high probability of a rate hike in December. What do you think about that possibility?
Well, here's where we have some good news. Right now, I mean, if you take a look at where we were maybe 3 or 4 months ago, it was looking like a 60%, and I'm trying to remember if it was 70% probability at one time of a Fed rate hike in December, especially after the Fed went 2 rate hikes in a row, once in January and then once in March. The good news is, according to the futures market, there's less than a 30% probability of a rate hike coming in December. It's now a little over 28%. And also, the possibility for a November rate hike is 2%. I can remember when there was almost a 30, 35%, 40% probability. We're down to 2%. We're down to below 30%. And then this week, we had Fed's Brainard and other couple of governors coming out talking about being more cautious about raising interest rates. So the probabilities keep dropping. It'll be interesting if they drop even further, depending on the damage of Irma in Florida and along the East Coast, because remember, it wasn't too long ago, 2 or 3 months ago, when especially when the economic numbers started to pick up and the PMIs were picking up, the probability of rate hike in December was as high as 60%.
You know, there's a seeming discrepancy here. There's a lot of geopolitical risk out there and talk of inflation, but, you know, they have that 2% number, which doesn't seem to ring. But in reality, it seems to be in a downtrend here rather than where the conversation is going. Why this discrepancy?
You know, the problem, And this has been one that's been puzzling a lot of economists, not only on Wall Street, but at the Fed, is the case of missing inflation. I mean, you had Q2 economic growth of 3%, but the year-over-year inflation rate in CPI was 1.7%. You have Japan's economy growing at 4% with 0% inflation. Europe's inflation is at 1.5%. Typically, according to economic theory, when you have greater demand and less supply, as growth gets stronger, it puts upward pressure on inflation. Well, that relationship has been broken. The growth relationship, and the reason that's important, that has been the fulcrum of central banking, and it basically forms a lot of the decisions they make. Whenever they see the unemployment rate drop, the economic numbers start to heat up, they say, inflation is coming down the road, so we better start hiking now. Well, that's what the Fed has been trying to do. But the economic numbers or the CPI numbers just aren't there. We haven't seen it in economic growth. And certainly now the CPI has gone in the opposite direction. And I think one reason is those models are flawed. Just as I told you, the stock market today is much different than it was 10 years ago. The relationship that we're seeing in the market is also much different. For example, good example is 2017 itself. Typically, when stocks are doing well, bonds aren't. But since the beginning of the year, we've had interest rates go down as economic growth has picked up. You made money in stocks this year. You also made money in bonds, even though the stock market is up 8 to 10%. Although 40% of the major indexes are in a downturn, the stocks making up those indexes, and you really have the generals doing it. But nonetheless, the markets are up and bonds are also up. So you have both of them going up at the same time. And the other thing that some people are saying is, look, the economy may not be as strong as it looks. Everybody's talking about the unemployment rate, but there are a lot of people that are displaced workers that aren't being counted. You've had the birth-death model play a lot of role in terms of some of these job numbers. And you also have the growing, what we call the gig economy, temporary workers. And then the other thing that's distorting this is all this QE that's been going on has been distorting the relationship and the interest rates that you typically see. For example, one of the earliest warnings of, let's say, approaching recession has been the yield curve. But how can you look at that as a reliable indicator when you have central banks that have been the largest buyers of bonds? That's why it is so interesting and why we're watching very closely. If the ECB begins to shrink its balance sheet and shrink its taper, at the same time the Fed is shrinking its balance sheet, then you just remove the two largest buyers of the bond market, which has been holding interest rates down. And that's where you can see, as John and I talked about in the first hour, where you could eventually see 3% interest rates, which would be the death knell for this economy. But right now, the number of reasons why I don't think we're seeing inflation, and it's not reflected in the Fed models, number one is globalization. You can build factories anywhere where it's cheaper to build. We've seen the decline of labor unions over the last several decades. We have multinational corporations that can move manufacturing wherever they can. You've got technology disruptors. And then also you have something that's also coming into play, economies of scale. I mean, you take a look at some of these big companies, the disruptors, the Googles, the Amazons, whatever market Amazon approaches, it drives down cost. And you're seeing it now. You're seeing it reflected in the prices at Whole Foods since Amazon bought Whole Foods. You're seeing it reflected in grocery stores. And so, John, a lot of these inflation numbers no longer hold up. And unfortunately, a lot of these models at the Fed are greatly outdated and no longer function in the way the economy and the financial markets work today.
So summarizing our conversation here today, number one, we're heading into storm season. There is a positive here. The economy is still growing, but we are beginning to see signs of weakness. There are three converging areas of storm. Number one, physical weather that we're going through right now. Two, geopolitical storms. And three, jitters in the financial markets. They're all converging. But given that, and the big threats coming from nature and politics, so to speak here, but what should we be doing in terms of investments during this atmosphere the way it is?
Well, I can just tell you what we're doing. We're anywhere between 20 and 40% invested in bonds, bonds that are doing well, and bonds that I would also appreciate given if the Fed continues to raise interest rates. We're more selective on the stocks that we own, a little bit more on the defensive side, dividend side, and defensive sectors. And like I said, John, they never ring the bell at a market top. You don't know if these three storm fronts we're talking about, weather, geopolitics, politics in general, and the financial markets merge together to form the perfect storm. Nobody's smart enough to know that right now. I mean, take a look at the way this year has turned out. Instead of going up, interest rates actually went down. Instead of being a moderate year for stocks, we're actually talking a good year for stocks, although it's converging very much at the top with the biggest stocks. So you definitely need to have some insurance here. I think, you know, it's like you'd be crazy to live along a hurricane belt and not have some kind of insurance or homeowner's protection. You need to be having some kind of protection in your portfolio. You don't want to leave yourself vulnerable to any one of these storm fronts, because quite honestly, I don't think anybody's smart enough right now to tell you whether these three storm fronts converge to form the perfect storm. We simply don't know that.
And very much like housing, the moral of this is you need to have some insurance. Otherwise, you could wind up becoming victim of a financial storm, just like being victim of a real storm. Coming up next on The Big Picture here on the Financial Sense News Hour, if you've been a listener to the show, you know that we frequently have Evelyn Garris on, who's a long-range forecaster, climatologist. She predicted earlier in the summer, right here on the program, that we would probably have a very tough hurricane season, and voila, that's what we are seeing right now. And right before Sandy, we did a show with Kevin Matsukato, who was the disaster preparedness consultant to governments and cities. And what we're going to do is run that interview right now, because look at Irma heading to the East Coast and two more stacked up in the ocean moving towards the continent. And so it's all pertinent as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Law enforcement biometrics refers to the application of biometric systems, which aids policing. And we're seeing a lot of growth in the industry generally. And a lot of that is led ultimately by law enforcement spending. So we approximate that half of spending on biometrics is spent on law enforcement worldwide. So it is a substantial component of the biometric sector. And we're seeing that as a trend going forward from 2015 to 2020.
Well, we've all seen it and gotten used to it. You turn on the evening news during the summer, we see hurricanes. Other times we see things from earthquakes, we see things from tornadoes and all kinds of disasters. Have we ever thought about preparing for one? I know I always used to watch them on TV. Until in 2007, half of the city of San Diego was evacuated as the city was on fire. Joining me on the program is Kevin Matsukato. He is a certified specialist in emergency. He is with Kuakina Corporation. Kevin, let's talk about something that we don't like to think about, and that is a disaster. I know living here in Southern California for three decades, it was something I never thought about until 2007, when over 600,000 people were evacuated out of the city. And thank goodness I had gone through your emergency prepared work, because I was prepared. So let's talk about why somebody should be prepared.
Exactly. During those wildfires, I firsthand experienced the wildfires when I was working at the Scripps Health. there are certain things that we should be prepared for during any disaster preparedness like that. Emergency resources may be limited around your community. It helps you and those around you survive those type of crisis situations. And mainly, if you're prepared for these type of crises, it reduces fear and anxiety. So a lot of times what we need to get informed of is disaster planning. You want to have your family members make a plan. That's a great start. Then you come up with an assembly of a disaster kit, and I'll explain a little bit more about that. And then when you have the plan and the disaster kit, you want to make sure that you maintain your plans and your kits. And you did mention some of the disasters that we can get ready for. Some of them are flooding. Also is hazardous material spills in the community. Yet we both experienced wildfires in San Diego. We don't have that much of a winter storm, but, you know, winter storms is one to prepare for. And another one is disease outbreaks. Heat waves, we have that a lot in San Diego. We want to make sure that everyone stays hydrated. And also, you said, tornadoes. So why is it, Jim, important to plan ahead? Well, it helps you to make a plan for your personal family, for home, or your workplace. Your family includes everyone in your household. Don't forget your pets. Pets are also a part of the family. In your workplace, you can educate your coworkers on disaster preparedness. So here's some specific tools that you want to prepare for during a disaster. You want to plan to survive on your own for at least 72 hours. You want to know your evacuation routes in your own home and your community. You want to create a personal support network with your family and friends. Plan for services to be unavailable. You want to identify your family contact. Do an inventory of your home and your possessions. Another thing is very important is to copy important documents, because during a crisis situation, you only have a short period of time to collect those documents. Some other tips you can do is to learn some basic first aid and CPR skills. If you have a fire extinguisher, you want to learn how to use a fire extinguisher. This is a good one, too, to learn how to shelter in place, meaning that if you don't have time to evacuate, you can find a safe place in your home. Normally, individuals, when they have a tornado, they go into their basement. But the shelter in place in your home is a good place to identify. And also learn your evacuation notices, where they come from. These notices come from, like, your local law enforcement. You can hear notices on your radio, your television, or even reverse 911. I talked a little bit about your pets to make sure you plan for your pets and service animals. What you want to do is to know the laws regarding pets and service animals in shelters. Plan for alternative safe locations for your pets. You want to prepare a disaster kit and carrier, if applicable, for your pet. And make sure your pets and service animals are properly identified. Make copies of vaccinations and shot histories. And make sure you keep a photo of you and your pet when you plan for a kit. And we talked about a disaster kit for the families in their homes. Here's some other tips that you can get prepared for and what you need for a disaster kit. It must be easily accessible in your home or your office. You want water. Water is very crucial in any time of crisis for everyone in the household for at least 72 hours. Non-perishable food for everyone in a household for, again, at least 72 hours. You want to have probably games and books for your children, again, to alleviate some of the fear and anxiety that's going around them. Battery-operated or hand-crank radios are excellent for a disaster crisis. Flashlights are the common ones with flameless candles. Make sure you have extra batteries. You want to get over-the-counter medicine. First aid kits are good in the event a personal family member or even your neighbor gets injured, and you can use those first aid kits. Change of clothes for members of the family. Grab some blankets. Have an emergency whistle just in case someone may get trapped. Hand sanitizers and personal hygiene items are also a good item. Plastic sheets and duct tape for sheltering in place. And most importantly, have some cash. When there's a power failure, some of the restaurants or stores or groceries, they won't have power to generate your credit card. So what they'll probably ask for is cash on hand. You want to make sure that you're practicing keeping your car, your gas tank, at least half full at times, and you can avoid gas station lines during a major crisis if you continue to practice with your vehicle having half full tank. And if possible, have your family contact an out-of-state relative or friend, informing them of your whereabouts and any update of your safety. What's happening there is that the city's cell phone system may experience an overload of telephone calls, which may not be inoperable.
What about keeping water and, let's say, a food supply? Because I've seen it, and you've seen it on the news, Kevin, where, let's say, a hurricane comes through an area. Good luck trying to find bottled water in a grocery store or a short food supply.
Yes. So that's a good question, Jim. What you probably want to do is go to one of your big markets, and you can buy it now instead of waiting for a crisis situation. The shelf life for water, it averages about 3 to 5 years. So you can look at the expiration date. You can store it. Then maybe every year after, you want to check on your water supply and storing your water in a safe and cool place where you can access it easily. So water is very important. You know, another thing that they might lose is the power failure. You want to purchase a emergency portable generator. Some of them cost about $100 or so up to $1,000. And it depends on the generator that will meet the needs of your family members. So that is an excellent tool to have for your disaster preparedness.
What about things like candles? I can remember, gosh, I don't know, Kevin, it was 2013 or something, where we actually lost complete power for the entire city because a power station between the Arizona and California border went out. And thank goodness we had candles and we had an outdoor barbecue and we had an emergency radio, because at first we didn't know if it was a terrorist attack. It turned out it was a power station that blew a fuse, basically. But what about things like that? Because what happens, and we've seen it, where power goes out. I mean, we've had power outages here in Southern California, and that's not unusual.
Yeah, I agree with that. One precaution regarding candles handled correctly and safely is a great tool. But sometimes you can have tooth disasters where a candle can easily ignite something flammable or something in your home. So I would recommend, as a safety specialist, to use a flashlight. Flashlights are easier to use. You can get now handheld flashlights. You can use a flashlight that connects to your head. You can get a strap with a flashlight, hands-free, because when you're walking around, you want your hands-free walking in the dark. A propane grill is an excellent tool for cooking some of the food that you might have stored prior to the disaster crisis, because you don't have electrical power, but you do have a propane tank, and with your grill, that will help you for at least hopefully 72 hours that you planned for.
The other thing too, at least this is something that really struck me during the 2007 fires, is really no exit routes. And Kevin, what about communication, so that if there is a disaster, tuning into a channel where you can get updates? Like, I turned into a channel and I was able to find out about certain roads and highways that were just jammed, and where there was areas where the fire, you simply couldn't be on a certain road.
Correct. So here at the hospitals, what we have, and I believe the public can also use, is that sometimes the radios are working and sometimes the televisions are working. So that will be your main resource for communications regarding roads being inaccessible. The other things that you can do is you can go onto the web. A lot of healthcare facilities, a lot of cities, state have their own websites. So they'll have their emergency information on routes as well. So if you do not have power, you still can use your laptop. You can use an air card, which our hospitals use during a power failure. We have air cards that you can use, and it's like a cell phone. It connects to cell phone communications. But the thing is that you can get information from your state or city resources for emergency crisis on your website, giving you directions and even how to prepare for a disaster that you're experiencing.
You know, what about this too? One of the things that we did and added to our disaster kit were very important documents like estate plan, insurance policies, and things like that. Because as you know, during the 2007 fire, a lot of homes were burned and destroyed.
That is correct. That is strategic planning for to get important documents like your birth certificate, your living will trust. Any documentations that are needed needs to be kept in a safe and easily accessible area in your home. A lot of families put it in a fireproof safe where you can easily access the safe. and go ahead and make sure that you have those documents with you when you evacuate your home. Those are important documents. Make sure you make copies of them as well. And you can also put your additional cash inside that safe, too, for emergency purposes only.
So we've talked about a number of things, documents, food, things you can keep around the house because, you know, quite honestly, you don't know what kind of disaster you're going to get hit with. Here in California, it could be anything from a power out to, as we've had recently, fires. What about, I keep thinking of what we see so often and can be so devastating. In fact, Kevin, you'll love this. The last time you and I did an interview was 2 weeks before Hurricane Sandy hit the East Coast. And I can't tell you the number of thank yous I got from individuals that lived in that area who had listened to the program and took preparatory steps that really made the difference for them.
Right. So living in Hawaii now, Jim, is that we're currently preparing for hurricanes here in the state of Hawaii. Technology is great because they can give you at least 72 hours in advance on the satellites if there's a hurricane coming to your state. So this is an excellent opportunity to make sure that you have your disaster kit ready. Another thing before you get your disaster kits ready also is securing your homes. You want to make sure that you can board up your windows, making sure your attic is secured, making sure anything on your rooftop or around your property that can fly away, you want to make sure that those are all secured. And that's what we're doing here at the hospitals. We're going into our roofs, we're making an assessment, making sure nothing flies off of our roof. Then we're making rounds around the building, same as your residence, to make sure that you don't have any loose tents or any loose debris, that when you have 75 mile per hour winds coming over your area, you want to make sure that these don't fly away. Also, you want to take a look at your landscaping. So if these trees that can damage your home, you might want to do an assessment to maybe trim down those branches or cut it down to a safer size. A lot of rubbish bins need to be secured because they're basically standing alone, but you want to make sure that they're also secured so they don't fly onto the roadway as well.
You know, you bring up a good point. In the last neighborhood, after the fires in 2007, there were ordinances that came through the HOA. In fact, they went through the whole neighborhood citing people that had trees that create a problem. Because obviously, if you have a big, thick tree like a eucalyptus tree, which can easily catch on fire and it's located next to your house, that's hazardous, especially in a fire zone.
That's correct.
So, Kevin, is there anybody that puts out, you know, I've seen some of these commercials on storage for food where you can buy 72 hours worth of food supply for a family. Heck, you can even order it from Costco. But does anybody make, or is there a company that makes a disaster kit that has a lot of the things that you and I have been talking about? Because sometimes people, you know, you're thinking about something and you're putting it together, and sometimes you'll forget the most important things.
There's some industry supplies that makes disaster kits. For example, hospitals use Grainger. Grainger has all the disaster kits regarding night flares, ropes, duct tape, flashlights, batteries, even water, even glow-in-the-dark vests. They have a lot of disaster preparedness equipment that you can use that the hospitals use. So that's a good point. That's a good question of what resources the community can go ahead and purchase some of these disaster supply kits.
I mean, is this something, Kevin, that you can order online, just go to their website, and it's affordable for most people?
Yeah, that is correct. You can go online. And like you said, Costco has also emergency supplies that you can just easily go online and order them.
And Kevin, in the things that we've been covering here, in your years in preparing and getting people to prepare, this is what you do for a living. What would you say are some of the biggest mistakes that people make in disasters, other than not to be prepared for them?
Yeah. Number one is always communication. Communication and fail to plan. So if you can have a good communication plan and a disaster plan, you'll be very successful in coming out even alive or sustaining these type of crisis situations. So communications is always the number one, where you're not communicating, you're not getting any information from the resources, you're not communicating with your family, you don't have a plan, you don't have a checklist. So those are the crucial things that you would want to try to avoid.
And, you know, another disaster that we've seen it on television recently, are terrorist attacks. And, you know, certainly like keeping water, a first aid kit in the car could be certainly something that comes in handy, because today you have to expect the unexpected.
That is correct. Unfortunately, what's happening is that we do have these terrorist attacks. We do have active shooters. So these are more high level, where the terrorists are looking at attacking first responders. They're attacking individuals where there are major events. That's why the security awareness is at a high level. When you go into an event, you have security personnel checking into your personal belongings and making sure they don't have any type of weapons or devices into these areas. So how to prepare for these type of events is having the awareness and education in regarding suspicious packages, suspicious persons, and just looking at areas where law enforcement can help you to recognize something suspicious that's happening. It's not our everyday routine that we see terrorist activities, but you can, by being aware and reading on resources like FEMA.gov, they prepare hospitals for these types of attacks, bioterrorism attacks. So you want to make sure you can educate yourself. Healthcare personnel go through training. And in fact, Jim, I'm glad you brought up that question. The community can go online to FEMA.gov and get certificates for emergency preparedness and even active shooters. So you might want to check out the FEMA.gov to get that type of information, education. And as you go to their study course, at the end of the course, it's about 20 minutes. You study for it and you get a certificate.
Wow, I didn't know about that. And what about simple things like, and I hate to even bring this up, but, you know, things like pepper mace or something like that. I never would have ever thought of that. But today when you turn on the evening news, it makes you think.
Right. You know what? Because of the new age right now, and because your family members are so vulnerable right now, and laws have passed and made it legal to carry pepper spray. I'm not sure about a stun gun, but pepper spray, they have alarms. My mom bought one off of Facebook, and it's an alarm, a personal protection alarm. And if somebody was to approach her or she feels threatened, Jim, she just pulls the pin and that alarm sounds so loud that it gets people's attention. So, yeah, I'm for that. I'm for personal protection alarms. I'm for pepper spray to protect yourself. And you use it if you feel your life is being threatened or you are being assaulted by someone and you're minding your own business, you're living your daily lives. But unfortunately, we do have some individuals that prey on the innocent in our country.
So, Kevin, if we were to sum this up again, give out the website, but before we do that, how about some key bullet items like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5? These are the things you must do and should do to keep yourself prepared.
Okay. Here, bullet point number one, you want to practice like maintaining your plan and your kit. You want to keep information updated on a regular basis. Change items in your kits every 6 months. Let your outside contact know where you keep your kit and what your plan is in the event of a disaster. And my last bullet point would be include your neighbors in your plan.
You know, that is really true, because a lot of times neighbors can come to your help. We saw this certainly during the fires that we had here, and we've certainly seen it in some of the disasters that we have had to watch during the evening news. And then, Kevin, finally, the website where they can get more information, as you talked about.
You can get more information on www.fema.gov, www.ready.gov, www.cdc.gov, and www.redcross.org.
Fabulous. Well, Kevin, as always, hopefully this isn't a prescient interview, because last time you were on, we were hit by Sandy, but I appreciate you coming on. This was a topic that I wanted to bring up, and we've had requests for this, especially from the kind of things that we're seeing and the events that we see, whether weather-wise or geopolitical-wise around the globe. Kevin, thanks so much for being so generous of your time.
All right, Jim. Thank you.
I hope you take to heed some of the things brought up during this interview with Kevin. I know him personally. He used to live here and took his advice. And I never thought I would have to use it. But we've had two incidents in San Diego. Major fire in 2007. And I think it was either 2010 or 2011. The whole city of San Diego literally went dark as we lost power as a power station on the Arizona border went out. And you never know what happens today, whether it's a hurricane, tornado, earthquake here in California, fires, whatever it is, be prepared.
So, Jim, coming up in the weeks to come, looks like things have now taken a slight shift. You know, as you say, we may be headed into a perfect financial storm. What are we looking for in the weeks to come?
I think the next big event will be the Fed meeting coming up here in September. Do they still stick to their script saying, hey, we're going to cut back our balance sheet, we're still going to raise interest rates? Or do we start to see some words that they're beginning to soften, which is what the futures market is implying, with less than a 30% probability of a Fed rate hike coming in December, which would be good news for the market. Also, once again, so much of this is going to depend on politics. What's going to go on with Washington? What are they going to do? Are they going to get a tax cut? Or will 2017 be much to do about nothing? If that happens, that's when the market finally will wake up, and maybe 2018 is where we run into trouble. But anyway, those are the things we're going to be watching. We got 3 weeks left here in September for the third quarter, so we're going to be watching earnings season so far. They've been stellar so far this year. Will that trend continue, which the market needs? And of course, if they do come together with the tax cut, if they do it for, let's say, corporate tax cuts, they cut the corporate tax rate from 35 to 20%, and then they also give a special one-time tax cut for anybody repatriating profits from overseas, that would be a huge stimulus that could hit the markets towards the end of the year, John. So much of this stuff that it is out there right now is really difficult to predict, because you don't know what Washington's going to do. You don't know what North Korea's going to do. And heavens, we don't even know what the weather is going to be like and how disruptive it'll be. I mean, look what happened to Texas with Harvey. So we don't know at the time we're doing this broadcast what kind of devastation will come with Irma. So a lot of stuff up in the air, but we'll be here to talk about it. But once again, I just want to leave you with this thought. With all of these hurricanes hitting not only Texas and now the East Coast, a lot of these economic numbers are going to be distorted over the next 2 months. So you can't make too much out of it. There are other indicators we're following that will keep you better informed than just the pure economic numbers themselves, because they are going to be distorted. Well, in the meantime, we just hope and pray that things are not as devastating for the East Coast, and especially Florida, especially when Cat 4 is supposed to hit by nightfall. By the time you're listening to this, we'll know more about it. Just hope it's not as bad. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we want to wish you a safe and pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.